It's The Takeaway for June 3rd. I'm Tanzina Vega. In the wake of another horrific mass shooting, you share your reaction to these events.
I usually avoid details as it's all a bit much to take in.
I try to find information out about the victims to honor them, but nothing about the perpetrators.
Sadly, with this most recent shooting, I realized I felt a little desensitized and I just kind of sighed like, oh, another mass shooting.
We look at the choices the media makes while covering shootings and how officials are changing the way they talk about suspects. Also on the show, what's happening in Israeli politics and how it affects the Trump administration's plans for a Middle East peace deal. Plus a dramatic rise in police killing civilians in Rio de Janeiro under Brazil's President Bolsonaro. And the Women's World Cup starts soon. We're talking about the U.S. team first in our coverage. Let's get started. On Friday afternoon in Virginia Beach, a gunman shot and killed 12 people at the city's municipal building. 11 of them were city employees. There have been 148 mass shootings in 2019 where four or more people were shot. It's a conversation we've had with you before, over and over. And your reactions from this weekend lead the show today.
This is Carrie from Pittsburgh. I think, oh no, not again. Then I avoid the news for a period of days until the next disaster or mass shooting occurs to take the headlines away.
This is Barbara from Richmond. I'm no longer interested in details because they seem to be always the same. Someone snapped, guns were readily available, people died. Our thoughts and prayers are with the victims' families, blah, blah, blah.
This is Richard from Haleiwa, Hawaii. I used to get really upset and wonder what's happening to America, but sadly with this most recent shooting, I realized I felt a little desensitized and I just kind of sighed like, oh, another mass shooting.
This is Frankie calling from Olympia, Washington. I usually avoid details as it's all a bit much to take in. I don't really feel like feeding it with my attention helps anything.
This is Mary from Lake Stevens. I think about victims, but I definitely avoid details. No mass shooting or everyday shooting, for that matter, will lead to a change in gun laws. The solution is purely political will.
This is Sydney Elkin from Moultrie, Georgia. I try to find information out about the victims to honor them, but nothing about the perpetrators. They don't deserve to be told.
These shootings have become so commonplace in American life that many of you told us you're becoming desensitized. You also told us that more attention should be given to victims than to the shooter. And to address this, city officials in Virginia Beach chose to identify the suspected shooter only once by name, referring to him after that only as the suspect. The focus, they said, should be on the 12 people killed.
Lakita C. Brown, Tara Welch Gallagher, Mary Louise Gale, Alexander Mikhail Gusev, Catherine A. Nixon, Richard H. Nettleton, Christopher Kelly Rapp, Ryan Keith Cox, Joshua A. Hardy, Michelle Missy Langer, Bobby Williams, Bert Snelling.
Among academics, there's a growing consensus that when media outlets center their reporting on the shooters themselves, that coverage has the potential to lead to copycat violence. And that's just one area where the media's role in how we cover mass shootings takes on an added responsibility. Today, a look at the way we respond to mass shootings in this country and how public officials and the media could do it better. I'm joined now by Nicole Dahman, an associate professor at the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communication. And Michael Greenberger is also here. He's the founder and director of the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security. And he leads a team that advises governments and private institutions on how to respond to catastrophic events like mass shootings. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael, let's start with you. The Virginia Beach police, as we mentioned at the top, made a point of only referring to the suspect once by their name, and after that, calling him simply the suspect. Why and how effective is that approach?
Well, the why is because as these events continue to be coming at us with a great rapidity, it is pretty clear that it's a best practice that if you focus too much on the perpetrator, that the chances of there being a copycat repetition of the kind of attack will occur. And the numbers on that are pretty extraordinary.
Nicole, I want to bring you in here because many of the callers we heard at the top of the show said that they were desensitized. And I'm wondering if you can help us understand a little bit about, is that desensitization to the act of mass shootings, or is it really, do you think, focused on how the media is covering or not covering these events?
Well, so the challenge from the journalistic perspective is covering these events in a way that gives us new information and isn't giving us the same thing over and over again. And so, yes, absolutely, there is the potential for the audience to become sensitized from this routine coverage. And so the challenge is reporting these stories, again, in such a way to give us new information, to get to the bottom of them, and to lead to solutions.
And what is, Nicole, our responsibility in the media to report the facts versus to prevent copycats?
Right. So the ethical responsibility from a journalistic perspective is to seek truth, which the journalists do, but also to minimize harm. And that's where the challenge comes in from this copycat perspective. So the media absolutely have a responsibility to report on these events, but to do it in an ethical way so that we're not leading to future carnage. And certainly no well-intentioned journalist wants to be able to do that. And so we need to find a new way to be able to report on the ongoing problem of mass shootings.
Michael, I want to bring you in back in here because we know that a lot of how these events begin to unfold is on social media, which means that you and I and everybody else has a role in basically reporting, and I'm putting reporting there in quotes, these stories out. How does that impact the authorities in their decision about how to move forward with public information? Or does it factor into the equation, Michael?
Well, it certainly does factor into the equation, and that is what has led the sensitivity to focusing on the victims and not on the perpetrator. On the other hand, as a person who's responsible for how you prevent and respond to these events, the fact that people are desensitized is somewhat worrying because there are things people can do to prevent maximum harm here. It's interesting that one of the people who survived the attack had been involved in a similar mass shooting in Texas in 2014, and he reported that he learned how to shelter in place and how to avoid being put in harm's way by having gone through that event, having learned about it, having been trained on it. Interestingly enough, the Virginia Beach Police on Saturday, the day after this event, were to hold an event in the municipal building teaching people how to shelter in place when they are in a mass shooting situation. So on the one hand, you don't want to encourage copycats, which is a problem. On the other hand, there are lessons learned here, not only for police and first responders, but for individuals in their own experience here. And again, when you say you're desensitized, I would just tell people this can happen anywhere, anytime, to anybody.
One of the things that I think comes up and has come up in this particular mass shooting is the image that was posted on the front page of the Virginian Pilot, which showed a man who was injured in Friday's shooting but survived. In the photo, the man is covered in blood. And I think it's probably one of the more graphic photos that we've seen that have been related to a mass shooting. Nicole, I'm wondering, New Yorker editor Michael Luo, formerly at the New York Times, wrote that images like that one might actually make consumers less numb. Do you agree with that?
So it is true that we haven't actually seen a lot of the blood and the carnage of mass shootings visually, the way they're reported in this country, are very sanitized. So there has been some discussion of whether or not seeing the actual graphic crime scene photos would sort of move us from complacency to action. One of the challenges from the media perspective here is getting access to these crime scenes because a lot of them happen, of course, in private facilities where the news media are not given access to capture the photos. So a lot of times what we actually just have are images that are taken with cameras from people who are inside the scene. And so that presents a different challenge in releasing those. But one of the arguments that I've been making, and many of my other colleagues who study this have been making, and it's a point that Michael made, is we need to find a new way to cover this. So he was talking about what we need to learn how to protect ourselves. So it's run, hide, fight. So that's something that the news media could include in every single one of these stories, right? So let's put that information in every single story that we write about. We also need more stories, and there's a lot already doing this, that point to solutions, right? So what are some potential solutions to alleviating the gun violence epidemic in this country? So a story recently talked about safe ways to get rid of your guns, or mental health coverage.
One thing that happens also, and I'd like to get your answer, Nicole and Michael, your reaction to this, is that we see there's a lot of, in the initial reaction to a mass shooting, there's a lot of care not to mention the perpetrator's name. But then there are big, in-depth reported profiles that come out about these folks. There's often a devotion to asking for the motive behind some of these mass shootings. Do you, Nicole, think that those are journalistically important questions that we need to be asking? And Michael, do those hurt or help what you are trying to do?
So it absolutely is important to identify the who in any journalistic story, but we still need to do it in a responsible way. And so that includes not including the name in the headline, not including the name and repeating it over and over and over. It's the repetition that becomes the problem. The perpetrator stories, the profile pieces, can be important in getting to some of the details of the how and why. The problem with those are the ones that report it in such a way as to essentially glorify these perpetrators, right? So to use some very sort of flattering language in some ways, or to hide the fact almost. So for example, there was a story recently in a big major news outlet that didn't mention the fact that the person here was a perpetrator of a mass shooting until 9 paragraphs into the story.
Michael, what about you? How does your business or what you do is impacted, if at all, by long profiles like this, by journalism that sort of takes this other approach?
Well, I don't know about long profiles, but that information, I think, is important. I agree completely with the fact that there needs to be sensitivity about how it's reported. But I was going to say that there is a policy development that's been abandoned by the Trump administration, which is as follows. If you trace the motivation for almost every mass shooting in the United States, the perpetrator was known to some significant person, entity, body as being a problematic person. And there is in the academic community, and we personally are working on this, the ability, if a person such as that is identified before a mass shooting as someone who might be problematic, to feed that person into the social service community. The Obama administration was starting to examine methods of doing this in a way that did not look at the racial profile of the person who might be involved. The Trump administration has turned this completely into a Muslim problem, focusing only on Muslims and not on white nationalists. But anyway, for example, in the Washington metropolitan area, a lot of the local governments are getting together to try and do a more sensitive approach about this, to allow people, without focusing on the race of the potential perpetrator, to feed these people into a system where they can be cared for, evaluated, looked at more carefully. And of course, if the person is bound and determined to conduct a terrorist act, well, at that point, probably law enforcement should be involved.
Nicole Dahman is an associate professor at the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communication, and Michael Greenberger is the founder and director of the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security. We appreciate you both taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Last week, President Trump's senior advisor and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, flew to Israel to meet with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The meeting, to discuss an Israel-Palestine peace plan being workshopped by the Trump administration, came at a tumultuous moment for Israel's government.
Even though we had a little event last night, that's not going to stop us. We're going to continue working together And we had a great productive meeting, which reaffirms that the alliance between the United States and America has never been stronger.
Netanyahu there speaking about the U.S.-Israel alliance after his meeting with Kushner. But that little event he referred to is actually a very big deal. After Netanyahu's Likud party won the largest percentage of votes in Israel's April elections, the prime minister failed to form a majority coalition. On Wednesday, Israel's Knesset voted to dissolve the newly elected parliament and hold another round of elections in September. Those new elections present a challenge for the Trump administration, which has formed a close alliance with Netanyahu. And the public rollout of a new peace plan is now likely to be delayed even further. Miriam Berger is a freelance journalist based in Jerusalem. Miriam, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the decision to dissolve the parliament and have new elections in September was a bit dramatic. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about why Netanyahu's party decided that.
So Israel's government is based on coalition-style parliament, also called the Knesset. And so basically, the prime minister is the one who has the largest amount of seats in his coalition. So it's 120 seats, so you need, in theory, at least 61. So Netanyahu, in the April elections, actually won, his Likud party won the same amount of seats as his main opposition, the Blue and White Party. But overall, Netanyahu had more coalition partners, more other people elected to the parliament on the right that would then partner with Netanyahu. So this system also enables small parties to then sort of have an outlandish role. So in this case, Avigdor Lieberman, who leads an ultra-nationalist but staunchly secular party, so he was pushing for a draft bill to conscript ultra-Orthodox Jews. And this is an issue that's been ongoing in Israeli politics. And so basically, Lieberman refused to join Netanyahu's coalition. He only has 5 seats, but he refused to join the coalition unless his version of the draft bill was promised to be the one that would be pushed through. And so, you know, this one issue then became the symbol for all of these other both sort of ideological and personal fights between all these different parties. And this is largely a fight between the right. And so it's been between Netanyahu's Likud party, who's sort of aligned more in this case with the ultra-Orthodox parties. They have a compromise that they've sort of agreed to. And Lieberman has said he's not backing down.
Mentioned earlier that Jared Kushner was in Israel last week to partly to discuss the Israel-Palestine peace plan. We have a clip here from his interview with Axios's Jonathan Swan about that plan. Let's take a listen to what he said.
I think that there are some things that the current Palestinian government has done well, and there are some things that that are lacking. And I do think that in order for the area to be investable, for investors to come in and want to invest in different industry and infrastructure and create jobs, you do need to have a fair judicial system. You need to have freedom of press, freedom of expression, tolerance for all religions.
And can they have freedom from any Israeli government or military interference?
I think that it's a high bar.
Miriam, what does this interview hint at us about Kushner's plan or lack thereof?
Palestinians from the start have said that this plan is biased against them and in favor of Israel's policies. And this sort of confirms a lot of those suspicions. The Palestinians say that they want to end the Israeli occupation and Palestinian sovereignty and freedom. And there's been questions about what that will actually mean in the plan, because as of right now, the approach that the Trump administration has taken has sort of been this two-tier one. They say we're going to focus on the economy first, and then we'll get to the political issues. Palestinians say you can't talk about fixing the economy without talking about the political issues. So, you know, you can't talk about increasing judicial or security you know, issues within the Palestinian polity without addressing the overarching Israeli occupation that informs it. So I think that this is sort of another sign for people that, as Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said in some released tapes recently, that he didn't think that it was going to be executable.
Well, I mean, and you mentioned separating the sort of economic plan from the political plan. And yet the president, or President Trump, I should say, has made several decisions that are very political, including moving the United States embassy to Jerusalem and recognizing the Israeli control over the Golan Heights. Doesn't that add to the fire here? I mean, are the Palestinians willing to negotiate given that?
So exactly. So this is part of why the sort of administration's claim that they're both, you know, doing a two-tier system, first economy, then politics, doesn't really add up when you look at actually the overall picture. And, you know, the Palestinian leadership, which is itself has a lot of problems back at home, is, you know, widely against and has said that they're going to boycott the Bahrain conference and, you know, any discussions with the Trump administration. And so, yeah, so you basically have two groups that are just not talking while one of them is seeking to make policy about the other.
How could this, essentially, this peace plan be impacted by the new elections that are slated for September?
That is yet again another complicating factor. So it's unclear. Elections now in Israel will be in September. So a government will be formed by sort of latest November. That's just about the time that President Trump will be kicking off his reelection campaign. And so the likelihood of him, A, pushing through something before Netanyahu, his staunch ally, is back in power and secure, is limited. And then the chances of him doing it afterwards when he's, you know, consumed with the reelection campaign is also seems slight. On top of that all, you also have a looming indictment for Prime Minister Netanyahu over several corruption cases. This has been ongoing for him for years. The sort of next timetable for this is that there's supposed to be a hearing in October regarding his indictment, where the Attorney General has said that he intends to indict him. And so all of this is now very complicated by all of these other timetables. So whether the hearing will still happen at that point for Netanyahu, what that will mean for his own, you know, corruption cases. And that is definitely something that informs his, you know, abilities to form coalitions and his strength domestically, which is something that Trump needs to rely on as well. So it's all a lot of moving pieces that right now aren't set up quite well for a lot of these main players. But I also wouldn't put them past them to, you know, create facts on the ground that benefit them as well.
Miriam Berger is a freelance journalist covering the Middle East. Thank you, Miriam.
Thank you.
Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro has been in office now for 5 months. The far-right populist was elected after running on an anti-establishment campaign, championing the country's military dictatorship and using racist and anti-LGBTQ rhetoric. But one of his main campaign promises was that he would stamp out crime in Brazil in brutal fashion.
Bolsonaro, throughout his career as a lawmaker, was a hardliner when it came to security. He was one of these people who would repeat this often heard phrase here in Brazil, saying, "A good bandit is a dead bandit."
That's Ernesto Lodogno, Brazil bureau chief for the New York Times, and he's been reporting on how police killings in Rio de Janeiro have been on the rise since Bolsonaro took office. According to government data, 558 people were killed during the first 4 months of this year. That's nearly five killings per day in one city alone. I spoke to Ernesto about the recent killings and how Bolsonaro's presidency is fueling what human rights advocates call extrajudicial executions.
When you look back at what was on voters' minds last year when they went to the polls, I think there were two issues that were really weighing on them. One was corruption. People were fed up by what they regarded as a political class that was hopelessly corrupt. And people wanted to sort of burn down the system. And they saw in Bolsonaro somebody who was such a radical figure and such an affront to the establishment that he could probably just sort of burn down the house and rebuild something new. But people also had been fed up with insecurity, with rising crime, with robberies that had gone through the roofs in recent years. And Bolsonaro and allied politicians campaigned on a promise that it would soon become easier for the police to open fire on suspected criminals.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the evolution of policing in Brazil. What are some of the tensions that have been historically present?
Well, some of the larger cities in Brazil have for many decades been hugely challenging to police. Rio de Janeiro, which is where I currently live, is no exception. You have a topography that makes the city very, very complicated to control. You have drug trafficking gangs that essentially control vast areas of the city. What I mean by this is if you wanted to go into one of these favelas, one of these sort of lower income neighborhoods, oftentimes up on the hills, you have to walk past gang members with rifles that are policing checkpoints to go in. And these areas have become sort of no-go zones for police officers unless they come in to carry out a raid. There was a time a few years ago when the strategy was to try to build these communities up so the appeal of these drug gang organizations wouldn't be as strong. And that paid dividends. You had a period when crime went down, homicides went down, and the state had considerable success in, you know, planting a flag in these communities and reestablishing state services. However, 2014 comes around, the economy goes into a recession, money that was earmarked for some of these projects dried up, and crime comes soaring back in. So this is the context in which Bolsonaro's very sort of heavy-handed approach becomes politically attractive to voters who were sick and tired of this.
And what has the reaction been among Brazilians about the recent spate of killings?
It's mixed. On the one hand, I think people living in these low-income communities that have seen a very sharp uptick in police violence, people feel afraid. You, for example, have a school in the district of Mare in Rio that saw fit to put up a big sign on the roof saying, "This is a school, please don't shoot." And this came after there had been operations involving helicopters that were essentially just opening fire on suspected criminals from the air. However, I think what's interesting about this uptick in police use of force and police lethality is that it coincides with an overall drop in crime, an overall drop in homicides. So I think there are many Brazilians who say, you know, the means may be pretty ugly, but we seem to be approaching, you know, some sort of momentum toward the right direction of reducing crime.
Bolsonaro has been president for 5 months now. Does he still have the same level of support that he did when he was elected?
Absolutely not. This is somebody who came into power with a very odd bedfellow patchwork of supporters. He drew support from evangelical churches, police, and army circles. He drew support from people involved in certain industries that wanted broader access to protected lands. But at the end of the day, once they got him elected and once he came into power, his ability to deliver on many of the promises he made to this very diverse faction of supporters has really been called into question. The economy is now in a period of stagnation, so people are very worried about their jobs and their livelihoods, and they see no sign that he is really delivering on an economic agenda or in a series of policies that is going to put the economy back on track to grow. He has triggered a bunch of controversies and a bunch of scandals that are sort of his own making, which has created an atmosphere of sort of chaos and animosity in Congress, where he has failed to sort of build a coalition strong enough to push through reforms or to really sort of govern in unison with Congress. And, you know, on the security front, even though some of the indicators are sort of looking better than they did last year, you know, the country remains hugely, hugely violent. And the state is not really equipped to go after some of these problems in a meaningful way because it doesn't have much money to play with.
Bolsonaro's son is facing allegations of corruption. What do we know so far about that investigation?
You know, I think this has been a really critical subplot in the Bolsonaro presidency. Here's somebody who billed himself as somebody who was going to let the judicial branch go after corruption unimpeded. And, you know, soon after his election, you had this scandal involving one of his sons, who is a lawmaker, who is now suspected of having run a criminal organization from his former office as a local lawmaker. And instead of kind of empowering the prosecutors and the federal police investigators and just sort of, you know, carrying out their work and looking under every rock, Bolsonaro's son has resisted at every turn the actions of prosecutors and investigators. And the president has shown no sign that he favors sort of a full and thorough investigation. And he and his wife are ensnared in some of these financial transactions that have drawn the scrutiny of investigators. So I think many Brazilians are starting to question whether the image that President Bolsonaro presented as somebody who was completely clean, a radically clean politician, is going to hold up to scrutiny now that he is in the highest office of the country.
Ernesto Londoño is the Brazil bureau chief for the New York Times. Ernesto, thank you so much for your reporting.
My pleasure.
This is The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega. Pull up like 20D, bet we just might shut this thing down.
The Women's World Cup starts this Friday in France, and The Takeaway will be bringing you different stories about the tournament and the teams over the next few weeks. But today we start with our own United States team. The United States are defending champions and the favorites this time around, and U.S. Soccer, the governing body, has been rolling out a marketing blitz for the team. By the way, the music you're hearing is from their slick roster announcement video. But at the same time, the star players are in an open legal battle with U.S. Soccer over gender discrimination. So what's going on behind the scenes? For that, we have Lindsay Gibbs, sports reporter at Think Progress and co-host of the feminist sports podcast, Burn It All Down. Lindsay, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what is the lawsuit that the players brought against U.S. Soccer?
Yeah, so this is a lawsuit under the Equal Pay Act and the Civil Rights Act of Title VII. And it says that they are being discriminated against because of their gender due to the fact that they've earned as little as 38% per friendly match than the men's team has. And they're also complaining about a lack of number of games, the location the games have been played, and coaching and medical treatments. They're applying for class action status. They want back pay, damages, and they filed this on International Women's Day 3 months ago. So they are certainly making a stand and making a larger statement with this lawsuit.
At the same time, as we mentioned, the season has begun. There is this odd tension here between the fact that the players are suing U.S. Soccer and at the same time, they're taking part in the marketing and promotion ahead of the World Cup. What does that tell us, Lindsay?
Well, look, I think they want to make this system that they work in better, and they're fighting for that. They're not fighting right now to burn the whole system down, but because they love what they do, they love what they stand for. But this has become very much a part of their story and a part of what they're willing to fight for. And look, it has been this way for the U.S. Women's National Team since the team was founded, since the very beginning in 1999, after those women won the World Cup. They boycotted some matches in order to demand a better contract. So this is just part of the narrative of who the U.S. Women's National Team is.
Of course, we know there are some that are being more visible and outspoken than others. Alex Morgan and Megan Rapinoe, are not being silent about their issues with U.S. soccer. Tell us a little bit about their approach.
Yeah, every time a microphone is in their face, they are willing to take this to account. I think they very much know that they cannot really be penalized. They have the platform, they have the talent, they have the skills, and they are really willing to lead this movement and maybe stand up for players who feel a little bit more vulnerable and feel like maybe their spot on the team isn't quite as secure. So I think that's been a huge part of this, is the fact that the biggest stars, the biggest names, are willing to address this. Now, they have said that during the World Cup itself, they don't want to answer a lot of questions about this. You know, they want to focus on what is happening, you know, on the field. They have it's going to be the most competitive Women's World Cup ever. So even though they're favorites, this is far from a given that they're going to defend their title. So I think, you know, they take that task very seriously, but they spoke about it openly in Media Day. And you're right, it is a little bit strange because these Media Days are being funded and run by U.S. Soccer. And they are, you know, they're there saying, yes, we're happy to be here, but we're not happy with exactly what we've been given. And we're no longer just going to sit back and pretend that everything is fine.
Has U.S. Soccer formally tried to prevent players from speaking about the issue, whether telling them that they're not allowed to do that or in any sort of media day, or are players allowed to say what they want to say?
For the most part, players are saying what they want to say, and whether I don't know that U.S. Soccer has much of control of this. I think for some of these players, their platform and their solidarity has outgrown, you know, the control of U.S. Soccer in some ways. And, you know, it's special that they are that they are using that platform, because so many women in so many countries don't have that power. still feel really vulnerable. So what they are doing is not just kind of empowering people within the U.S. system, but I think it is helping women who are fighting their own battles within the women's soccer community globally, and also just women who are, you know, more vulnerable in their places of work who want to speak out. So as far as I'm aware, there hasn't been any direct pushback, though I know behind the scenes it is a tense time.
So, Lindsay, the players took a different tactic in dealing with U.S. soccer before the 2015 World Cup. Tell us what their strategy was then and how it's different from today.
Yeah, well, a lot of the focus around the 2015 World Cup, remember, they hadn't won a World Cup since 1999. So there was a lot of pressure to get back into the championship trophy. But a lot of the focus was on suing FIFA for the artificial turf that they were being forced to play on in Canada. So that was a lot of the focus leading up to the Women's World Cup in 2015. After that is when they really found their activist voice, because in the victory tour after the Women's World Cup, they realized we're selling out, we're doing all these things, and we're still getting paid so much less than the men's teams are. And we're having to play on turf, which is very dangerous, and the men barely ever have to play on artificial turf. At one point in Hawaii, they went to a match and the turf was peeling off the field, and it had rocks embedded on it, and it was so dangerous that they ended up boycotting that match, and U.S. soccer had to cancel that match because the conditions were so dangerous. So during that victory tour, I think is when they really realized, well, we finally got this win again. Our popularity has never been greater, and yet that hasn't solved any of the problems about treatment, you know? So that's when you saw them launch the Equal Play, Equal Pay campaign, which really took over social media. And then in 2016, they launched a wages discrimination suit with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in the federal government.
And in terms of, I mean, we obviously know that these games are going to get a lot of eyeballs. Lots of folks are excited about the season. If there are fans who want to somehow get involved in supporting U.S. soccer, what should they do?
You need to watch. You need to tweet about it. You need to like all their posts on social media. Tell your friends to watch. It could seem a little bit counterintuitive to support these matches and these social media accounts that are run by U.S. soccer, who these women feel like are discriminating against them. But the more clicks that these things get, the more that these women can show their marketability and how important they are to the U.S. soccer community and to the worldwide community, the more in demand they can prove that they are, the more that's going to help their case and the more that's going to strengthen their ability to continue this fight.
And we've just got a couple seconds left. Just curious, do we know a timeline for this case and more or less when we should expect to see a result?
I've heard that probably early next year, as we know, these court cases take quite some time.
And we'll be watching. Lindsay Gibbs is a sports reporter at Think Progress and co-host of the feminist sports podcast, Burn It All Down. Lindsay, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.